Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a special business meeting of Ashland Park and Recreation Commission. We're here in the Grove. It's February 10th, 2020. And first on our agenda is public forum, which I don't have any requests to speak. So we'll move to additions or deletions to the agenda. The only small request I have for any changes tonight is Commissioner Lewis says he needs to leave at 6:30. And I'm not sure if we'll get to the pool design approval, but we'll do our best to get there before you have to leave.
Do you want to move it?
Well, we could move it and take the first number one under new business and do that first and then move back to unfinished business.
It won't take long, that's for sure.
Is there any objection to that from other commissioners? Okay, well then what we'll do is we'll adjust to jump to new business number one, full design approval contract, and then we will immediately jump back to unfinished business and pick up with the Japanese garden update. So I'll turn it over to Director Black.
Okay, so this is a business item. This is why we have a special meeting tonight, so that you can make a motion on this to approve the contract, hopefully, and then move it on to the City Council. The only reason the City Council has to approve it is because of the amount of the contract. It's a procurement rule that anything over $100,000 the City Council has to approve. So we've always honored that, and we've always gone through that process. So this is not new. So just to go back a little bit, we had put out for an RFP. We solicited comments through an RFP, or it's actually an RFQ, request for qualifications for a designer for the Daniel Meyer Pool. That process ended in January, and we were able to go through and rank the only two proposers who came in the only two respondents. That was Robertson Sherwood Architects and Terrain Landscape Architecture. After going through and looking at all of their qualifications and basing it on the information that we put out in the RFQ, which we gave them information of how we were going to score, we were able to rank the two of them, and we put Robertson Sherwood Architects ahead of Terrain Landscape Architects. A big portion of the scoring went to Robertson Sherwood because they have a lot of history with the kind of thing we're looking at, specifically with the kind of pools we're looking at, specifically with cities around our size, and specifically with the size of pool and budgets that we're looking at. The architects, we're really comfortable with them because of some conversations we had with them. They are aware of our aggressive timeline and our budget, which is very important, the budget that we do have and the timeline that we're looking at. They're also aware and mentioned in their response to the RFQ that they acknowledge that we have already created a preliminary plan that they would come in and start with that and move forward with that, knowing that that has gone through a public process already. The bid came back. After we went through the qualification process, we then negotiated on price. The actual fee came back at $151,000 for services and $9,500 for reimbursable expenses, which would include travel and things like that. So we're looking at $160,000 for this contract, which we believe is reasonable. And yes?
Did we have a estimate of what we were expecting to spend on that?
Well, no, not really. We had budgeted $115,000. That was our stab at what we thought would be the minimum. We had originally budgeted, I proposed $150,000, and then we kind of whittled it down through the CIP process. But what we have is a project that's funded at $2,715,000. 160 of that will need to go towards design, and the rest will be for contracting out and bidding the project and construction.
And just one more. And where are they based out of?
Eugene. Okay. Yeah.
Some architectural bids deal with shepherding the project through, and some are a single cost. Does this deal with them as an ongoing process?
This fee actually includes being on site, I think, at five different times throughout the process, being here on site throughout the construction at five different times to monitor, give information, clear up any issues that there might be. So that does include going through construction process. What they bid on was providing pool designs, getting us through to bid documents, taking it out to bid, and then shepherding the process through construction as well.
Commissioner Watt, and then Commissioner Bell.
Well, I have three things. First, it sounds like then there will need to be a project manager for the project. Who will that be?
Jason Minica will be project manager for this project. They will also have a project manager on the construction side that they designate when we go out for bid.
Sure. And then just a comment. It seems to me that 5% or a little over 5% of construction costs seems like certainly seems in the ballpark for what to expect. In fact, it almost seems a little low from my perspective, but at least it seems in the ballpark of what to expect for design services. And then third, I think this is something that you just put in here because we already talked about it, but it struck me a little worrisome. But I think it's just a repeat of something from before. It says, since the bond payments for the new pool will not begin until 2021, staff does not expect any impact on the current two-year CIP plan for the approval of this project. Well, that's something already new, correct? And so you're not trying to say something different.
Right, and that's actually some language that has to do more with the revenue bond than it does with the actual food and beverage monies that are already in there.
I understand that. Yeah. I understand that. But it's nothing new, is what I'm getting at.
No, it's nothing new.
Because you've already told us, we've already kind of known that this, because when the bond would come out, money would be there, and when we have to make a first payment, it won't affect. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure there wasn't something new.
No, there's nothing new. We expect that the bond will be issued somewhere in the May timeframe. We plan to order the pool if we can get on the right time schedule. Somewhere in the May, April, May timeframe with a letter of intent and actually pay for it upon receipt, which won't be until July.
And July of what year?
2020, which is fiscal year 21. Which means that we aren't incurring any expenses. We don't need to draw on in the fiscal year. We won't need to draw on the funds until the beginning of the fiscal year, and therefore pushing it out farther. So
Commissioner Bell had a question.
I guess the cost of this work is to come up with the design of the pool, which to some extent we already have a sketch of anyway.
Right.
Yes.
And then they are going to oversee they're going to be the managers of the process going forward, and we are still going to be paying somebody else to do the actual building and for the materials.
Right, so I wouldn't say they're going to be managers of the process going forward. What they will do is, as the designers, they will periodically check in and provide clarification on their design and instructions where they need to. We will be managing the fiscal side of it and overseeing the construction. There will be a company that bids on the construction who will provide a project manager who will oversee the construction side on their side.
And then we will also have Jason, who's involved.
He's
side by side with that.
Exactly. Manager. Yeah. That's the way it usually works. Is there's usually two project managers, one from their group, one from our group, and but it's not his full-time job, Jason's full-time job. But it will be this person from who's on site every day, their full-time job, and Jason will check in with them daily, probably.
And so the payment for all of this work is going to be in July of 2020, which is fiscal year 2021.
Right.
And I don't understand the time frame correctly. That's the end. The project will be complete by then.
No, the project won't be complete until the end, till the middle of fiscal year 2021. Payments are due. We're going to have to get all this information, but back from we don't even have the bond yet, but we're expecting the bond we're hoping not to need the bond, and we're expecting not to need the bond until after July 1st. And the reason for that is if we draw in July, it will be in that fiscal year, and the payment, we'll have to find out when the payment's due through our process of securing the bond. But we're trying to push out payment as far as possible, actually.
Okay. I guess my last question is, so I don't know enough about paying for big projects like this, but we don't, as a sort of a typical thing, pay for half of it up front and half of it on completion?
No. No, we pay for it as we go. We won't pay we won't pay for the pool until we receive it. Because we're a governmental organization, the company that builds the pool will build it based on a purchase order or a letter of intent, basically saying we promise to pay you, or showing that we've gone through a governmental process approving the funds in order to pay for that, and they're comfortable going forward based on that without receiving payment up front. Because we are a government. If we were building a pool with the same company in our backyards, it would probably be completely different.
Sure. Mr. Heller, you talked about when the hope is that the pool construction is finished. I imagine it's a little challenging to know when you don't even have a contractor. But you used only fiscal year a term. So can you give me a calendar year time of what the hope?
Yeah, so our best projection right now, which is still not solid, but our best projection, best case scenario, is finishing in at the end of the calendar year, this calendar year.
End of 2020.
Yes. And open for winter. What would it be? High school sports. I guess that would be. I'm not sure if swimming's still going on, but water polo would be soon after. Things like that, and you know. So that's the quickest path puts us at construction finishing around December timeframe, November, December, being able to open at the beginning of the calendar year in 2021.
And that also implies pools totally shut down this summer, right?
Yes, it does. Now the alternative, and we don't know yet, but one of the things that I could come back, and it's totally possible that I could come back and say we can't get the pool built. Like, we could do everything, like get it all designed, get a contractor and everything, but we don't have the actual pool to put in the ground until October. That is a possibility, depending on the timing of the bonding and a couple of other things. If we order the pool, man, I'm kind of getting pretty far into this, past what we need for this contract, but if we order the pool in April or May, that means we're really cooking along, and we know for certain exactly what the pool is going to look like and everything, which means we've had a couple of public meetings, and you guys have seen it, and everybody agrees. If we can't order it in April, May timeframe, then that pushes it out, and the company that builds the pools, they all take the whole month of August off, apparently. So the soonest, after that time frame, the soonest we could get a pool delivered to us, it would be October. So.
Well, I'd just like to make a comment. I don't know if it's relevant that I'm gone for the next month-ish, but that I would rather inconvenience, you know, a small group of high school swimmers and keep it open for the summer, if that's an option. I don't know that we're going there, but I want to just be out there with that.
I think it is an option to stay open for the summer at a price. I mean, we're going to have to pay a company to come in, and potentially, anyways, we're going to have to pay someone to come in and do some repairs, because we've done repairs that right now. I mean, we've got some things that are working well, and our staff has done a really good job, but I don't think anybody put a warranty on that stuff. Did you put a warranty on that, Mike? No. There's no warranty right now because we've made things work.
Right. No, I understand that. And I'm just saying that the option of if we can delay it 2 months and if it can work to be open, and I realize that's still to be decided, but I would rather have it open.
Well,
that's
direction you can give to us if you, as a commission, if you'd like to give that to us. Our goal has been from the beginning to move forward as quickly as possible, and the goal of the Parks Commission is to keep Daniel Meyer Pool open unless it's under construction.
That's it. Sure does.
And it seems like we got to let this play out, really. Mm-hmm. And some of it might not be in our complete control, so
right.
It may go that direction. And
I don't mean to debate this right now.
No.
So yeah, some of these things will work themselves out. I mean, it is a very aggressive schedule to order this pool in April, and it might be the right timing, and it might not be the right timing. I'll leave it at that. So,
where's the manufacturer?
They're in Italy.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh,
is it Italy? It's Italy, right? It's Mirtha Pools. Yeah, they're in Italy.
Okay.
We're gonna get a fountain while we're over there and bring it back.
And a little Lincoln guy.
Yeah, Lincoln Head too. So,
it's February now.
Mm-hmm.
We're just getting ready to hire these designers. Don't they have to finish their work before you order a pool?
Yeah, you would think, wouldn't you?
I don't get it. It doesn't, to me, it sounds totally unrealistic.
You don't think they can do it that fast?
No. Oh,
There is one option. There is an option where it could work, and it could work if. It's very clear that, I mean, we're looking at a pool that's a certain size, okay? And if the pool fills this area, and we just need to make sure we have this area for the pool, we can continue to work on the perimeter and figure out retaining walls and things like that after we know what's going to work for the pool.
It just seems like you're hiring these designers, and we want to make sure they do kind of a truth test of what we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't do that truth test until they've actually been on the ground and started to work. So
it is February the 10th, and we're talking them being on the ground and working for months. We've done an Alta survey already. We have underway right now. Geotechnical work is underway right now. You know, so I think there's a possibility it could work. If it does, it does, and we'll be able to say it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't, and that's just that. So, and you'll be able to decide on that, because it's going to be about a $1.3 million expenditure. So you'll have the last word on it. So.
So to get the ball rolling, to make a motion to approve the RFQ for Robertson and Sherwood Architects to start the construction drawings at the agreed upon price.
Okay. Is that going to cover what your recommendation was? That we I accept that second, but just let me.
Yeah.
The recommendation was to move to the City Council for approval of.
I think the wording is fine. You can approve it, and that is a recommendation. It's not you're approving it and they're approving it. I think it's fine the way that that is.
No,
I don't think you need to.
Okay, further discussion?
I guess one of the things, the fact of the matter is that we put out an RFQ and we had two proposals, and this was the better one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are confident that this is, not that the other group wasn't good, they're just fine, but with the history that they have, that they were able to demonstrate, the references that we checked, the budgets of the projects that they've done before, and the likeness of the previous projects to ours, really comfortable with this group.
Yeah, it did seem like some of the other projects that they described in their list of different contracts or whatever, mm-hmm. commissions. were very similar, mm-hmm. or at least had elements that were very similar, same size, same, you know, zero depth entry, etc.
Right.
I would just add to that, you know, I agree that it's an aggressive timeline, but the fact is that if for some reason we didn't attempt that aggressive timeline, because, you know, we're not going to lose anything if it just can't be done in that timeline. The only thing we're going to lose, though, is it's probably going to cost us a lot more money to keep Daniel Meyer Pool open this summer. It would be to our advantage to be able to decommission that pool sooner rather than later, since we have no idea how long the infrastructure will last through the summer. So I personally, you know, encourage staff to go aggressive and see if we can, you know, if we can get this project underway. You know, we have the funding, the timeline's tight, but I think those are important factors. Any other comments?
Well, not in contrast to what you said, but I think it's also important, in addition to the cost of the pool, to acknowledge that the greatest benefit to the greatest number of citizens is having a summer pool, if that's an option. So I just would want to have that as well.
You know,
sure.
I was going to say that we are going to be working as staff on a communication plan, and then we'll work the pool that will include a list of places that people can go to obtain other swim lessons. We're going to be working really hard to make sure that we get the word out on whatever decision we make as a team. So.
Yes, Mr. Long.
And I support moving forward. I have to say that I think one of the reasons why I'm a little bit, I guess I'm a little surprised, the timeline has actually changed. At one point, the concept was to get this thing done outside of the summer months. And but I think there is some logic to getting it done as soon as possible. And yeah. So if that aggressive works, but if we're getting up to where it looks like it's, you know, it's not going to get started until the end of summer, then I think we need to make the extra effort and spend some of our precious operation fees or funds on keeping it open through the summer.
So what you're seeing, do you mind? What you're experiencing is that we had an impossible time frame that we were shooting for first. Now we're at the next to impossible time frame. And then eventually we'll get... Now, we really hope that we can accomplish this time frame, and we're really shooting for it. But reality will be what reality is, and we will bring it back to you, and you'll see.
Can I have a roll call for the show?
Commissioner Long?
Yes.
Commissioner Bell?
Yes.
Commissioner Lewis?
Yes.
Commissioner Heller?
Yes.
Commissioner Gardner?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Great.
We have to take that up.
Okay, we will readjust our agenda and move back to unfinished business. And first up will be Japanese Garden update. And once again, I'll turn it over to Director Black.
So we've got, this is just an information item. And what I've vowed to do is continue to bring you updates and do this in public meetings so that anybody who's interested can come and hear what's going on. It's been noticed on our agenda, and people who are paying attention can look and see that if they want to. So what we're going to talk about today is what we're calling the first phase of moving forward with this project. But we've had a couple of changes that in our organization and how we're approaching the design of this project and getting to the point where we can bid on this project. And you'll notice that Carrie Kincairn is here, and Carrie Kincairn has been she's been contracted by the Ashland Parks Foundation to work with Toru, who's the lead designer. Would you say that's correct?
Yes.
He's the lead designer, and she is working with him to come up with the plans that we need in order to move forward to meet our contracting requirements and the plans that we will need eventually to bid this project out. So Carrie's instrumental in this process going forward. It hasn't technically, she's still being paid by the Ashland Parks Foundation until we get the bid package ready to go and everything. I think that's the best way to do it. Yeah, a question?
Isn't all the money coming from the foundation?
It is, but eventually, so what? When we bid this out, though, we have to bid it out as a public project, and the foundation can't do that. This is going to be a Boley project and things like that, so we need to bid it out through the city of Ashland or Ashland Parks and Recreation. This part, however, we can do this way, and I think that this is the most efficient way to do it as well. So what we're going to talk about tonight, and Carrie's going to explain the plans that we have, but in order to move forward, we're on a time frame where we need to start working on a few items quickly. One of those items happens to be tree transplanting and shrub and bush transplanting as well, which is, we don't show all the small shrubs and bushes on here, but a lot of those are going to be transplanted as well. What we're showing on D1 and on T1 actually, whichever one you have, you can take a look at either one of those. We have, let's look at T1, if you've got that. Do you have that?
I don't have one for me anyway.
Okay. So if you have T1, and if you look at that, Carrie has laid out with guidance from Toru, all of the trees in the area that we're working, and she'll explain kind of the colors and things like that. We need to get moving on this because of time frames. So Carrie, I'm gonna run. I'm not gonna try and explain it right now. We also have a tree protection plan that Carrie will explain. We've gone through and done that. I know there might be some comments on that. And it also shows the boundary of construction, the construction fencing, things like that. And then the last thing that we've provided to you is just the overall plan as we have it to date. And Carrie has worked with Toru for long hours. Toru came down and spent a lot of time at her office, and Carrie has put this together. Going forward, we're going to be working off of Carrie's plans, which she will be working with Toru to produce, which makes us very happy because Carrie knows everything that we need to move forward with bid documents and all those types of things. And we're getting to a point where we're dealing with, would you call it more exact?
I would just say that it's geographically based.
Yes. So we have a lot more confidence going forward in the plans when we see them in this format. So I'm going to turn it over to Carrie to explain. But the goal today is to inform you of the process that we want to move forward on going for really soon here within the next couple of weeks, which will be transplanting and, basically transplanting. Soon after that, we would like to start demo, which would be in the next 2 months. But I'm just telling you now that as we're moving forward, we may decide to move forward at the earlier part of those 2 months or the later part of those 2 months, which demo would require us to put up the full fencing, and then we'd be taking out sidewalks, moving boulders, taking down the trees that are going to be removed. So I'll be able to answer more questions on the process. I'm going to turn it over to Carrie to talk about the plans that we have.
Okay, so interrupt me as you wish.
Can I just start just asking? Well, because south and north are not my image of where the entrances are. It's more east and west in my brain. So can you clarify? Wait, I know it on that.
Here's the entrance. Right there.
Yeah, this is
okay,
the
actual
entrance.
Okay,
so
great.
Thank you. Windward.
Okay, now I'm for
you. Okay, so as I said, interrupt me.
I figured it was geographic,
except for Joel.
So, I'm just going to stand up and hold these up and talk.
Or maybe put them on a chair or something.
Okay. Well, I can help. Oh. You need to move around.
I do? Okay.
If you want to. Yeah. I want to give you that 3 minutes.
So, what we did first, well, not exactly first, but there's two things going on at the same time. One was, with the help of Mike Oxendine and Keith, coming up with a really good tree inventory. And you have that tree inventory, and so the orange dots are the trees we're taking out. The purplish blue dots are the ones that we're protecting, and the green ones are the ones that are getting transplanted. Now, there have been lots of versions of what's going to stay and what's going to go through time, I guess. And when Toru came last time, my goal was to, okay, let's make a final decision on this stuff. So this represents me walking through the garden with Toru twice. And then it's been edited a little bit based on me starting to work the grades and see what's possible. There's probably going to be a little bit more of that that'll happen. But the thought is that we can save those trees if we take care of grading using some small walls, just kind of making the paths move through. Because the challenge is, you know, trees are all set in space, set in the grade, and we have to put a creek through there and paths through there. And previous to now, that wasn't really taken into consideration when you looked at the concept. So we did this, and the concept followed. So it's a much better idea of what actually can work. Does anybody have any questions on this before I move to a different?
So only three trees being replanted, it seems like a small amount.
It is. Now, I haven't graded the whole design yet, so there's still another phase of reality that will potentially...
Well, let's just spit it out. It's very likely with the change of grade that there'll be more trees allowed to be moved.
I was trying to spit it out.
Did I interrupt you?
More trees may have to come out, but
okay.
That's not the intention. And clearly none of the trees in the perimeter on the sides are going to be touched.
So some of these trees that you see in purple are trees, and at least one of the green ones, maybe all three of them, are trees that after walking several times, somebody has said, well, we need to try and save that one, or we need to, you know, that kind of stuff has happened too. So,
yeah.
You know, we're being pretty aggressive on the number, on the ones that we can save.
These two green ones were actually in an island in the original pond design, and in looking at how that was going to work, it wouldn't work. You know, the trees would be killed. So they're valuable trees, so we're going to dig them up. Now, whether they won't go back in the park, probably they'll get dug and put somewhere where they're of value, which makes more sense. It'll be healthier trees that way.
Are you talking about trees that are being removed or trees that are being transplanted?
Transplanted.
Because I just took the walk through the park with the map, and I was struck by trees that I value a lot more than personally those dug firs. I was surprised the number of solid, existing, well-root-structured, well-canopied trees that are... I was surprised, but I also understand we're doing a major project, and I was struck by that.
Yeah, I can't speak to the value of what, you know, where we are politically with the trees right now. I can just kind of speak to what I've been able to accomplish looking at the design and reality of the situation.
Well, and I can say, though, that, you know, through the process, it's always been known that we were going to take trees out. There was a process that we went through that stalled out, and we came back, and part of the discussion anyways, I don't know if it actually remember if it made it in the motion or not, was that if we do what we can, these are the trees that we're really trying to save the most, the Doug firs. Then we understand that there's an understanding that some other trees are going to come out, but for the sake of the project, this stand of trees need to be saved.
And this.
Yeah, and all of that stuff. There's trees that are being protected. There are trees that are coming out, but that's just the totality of the project.
But it's the tree. It's what I was struck by was the number of trees in the current Japanese garden that have been part of the Japanese garden. That I don't know if in the new design it just wasn't viewed as that can work at all or whatever. But it didn't. I was just surprised by the number of mature trees within the Japanese garden that are leaving. I just was surprised.
Surprising.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the priority is the healthy, long-lived, large trees. That's what we would want to maintain. But I think that, you know, it goes back to something that some of the gardens said a long time ago, which is, you know, when you garden, you know, you pull up things, and move things so you can put something new in. We're putting in a huge new amenity to the park, and unfortunately, you can't have it keep everything the same and do the big amenity.
And Commissioner Bell had a question.
Oh, sorry. So, going back a little bit, you said that you had
Is this, so looking at it from like the surface, yeah, if you were, is it the same design as Tor originally came up with, or it has been modified?
Okay, so we'll get to the concept in a second. Okay. But so you have it. So what we did was took Tor's design and traced it into the computer. He had, through his design, identified in a few places where trees to be saved were. There was a couple of key things. But Tor's design was not to scale nor to reality. So we cut it up into pieces after we traced it, and we puzzled it back together on the site based on the trees that were being saved. And then we redrew it into the computer based on that, and then I sat down with Tor. And I said, does this still represent your intent?
Okay, so it wasn't like some part of it was thrown away and you get this put in or something like this?
There's only one thing that I put in that isn't his intention and he hasn't seen it yet.
Well, and for all intents and purposes, this is still a Toru Tanaka designed Japanese garden.
Yeah, so the only thing that's different, I mean, that sounded weird, but basically the design wasn't going to be ADA. So that's kind of what's driving a lot of this. And so that it will continue to shift as grading dictates the thing needs to move. But the path is where the way he wants it to be, the creek and the pond and all those elements and all the structures are his intention, and the details will all be run by, like everything will go back to him for approval.
I mean, the rooms are in the same place, right?
Yeah, they're just...
It might be tweaked a little bit.
So, well, we had to move some of, like, we had to move this entry down.
Yeah.
We had to move this over, you know, things like that.
So these changes would have happened even if we didn't hire Carrie. The problem is we wouldn't have known it going into the project what the changes were going to be. And what the value we have now is we're marrying the plan to reality, and we can see where we're going to end up. Where before Toru put together a great plan and everything, but a lot of his philosophy is I'll figure it out, you know, as we're going along, and that just doesn't work for us. So
yeah, and I'm not criticizing the process. I'm just curious to see what happened.
So the main difference, just so you know, there's a path here that comes across the pond and connects back up. So basically these rooms that are mainly hardscape that are towards the entry of the bottom of the garden are connected by a path that crosses over the pond and connects back around, because that part I know I can make ADA. So I added this path so that I knew that I could get an ADA path through
with
the bottom
circulation.
It's this one right here.
It's right here. It's all of this whole thing, the circulation is ADA accessible.
And to define ADA accessible. It's good in surface and it's good in width, but it's not necessarily good in grade. Then, is what you're saying.
Well, what I just talked about is good in grade and surface and
the rest of the battles.
Yeah. And we'll get.
It's ADA to a point except for grade.
Well, and these
rocks are not ADA
challenge.
Yeah. Well,
it's called life.
Yeah, yeah.
You could call existing terrain. It's called
what?
Geology.
Whatever they're saying.
I'm sure this isn't the way it really is, but it shows a waterfall basically coming out of a pump house.
Yep, that's the way he wants it.
But you won't.
The waterfall, so this tripped me out. I sat with him for hours to understand how this works. So the pump house in the back is at least partially buried. And then the way he designs them is that the water actually comes through the top of the pump house and spills down the face of it, and it's built into this waterfall.
Okay, so the pump house is built into the waterfall.
The pump house is the origin of the waterfall. The roof of the pump house is the origin of the waterfall.
Is there a pool on the top of it then?
Basically.
A pool on top of the waterfall.
Oh, well, yeah, a little pool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I know we're talking about my
nature. No, I've been talking to him about details, and it's fascinating. It's like, I would never do something like that, but that's great.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, it really was like mind-changing.
But just to be clear, though, this is screened into the waterfall. The pump houses. We're not seeing concrete from here looking over.
No. Okay. But, you know, the way that he talked about doing, like, the edge of the water, it's going to be his design and his execution, but I'm not, like, the pond, let's say, has a 6-inch bond beam, so the concrete is 6 inches thick, and you have 6 inches of concrete showing at the top of the pond. Some of that will be covered by rock, and some of it will be covered by plants, but in his way of building these things, the plants screen the concrete, but it's there, and it's visible.
Yeah.
So,
Karen, do we know how tall the waterfall is?
It's like six or seven feet. Yeah, that was the idea. And as far as elevation goes, we can get that information, but from the bottom of where the pump house is, it's 1, 2, these are 1 foot, right?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to the curve.
Yeah, so we're going to backfill behind that pump house, so the grade will kind of, it'll go back into the grade. Right.
One other small question for you, and I'm not sure if I'm here, but it looks to me like unless there's a post under there, that bit's going to fall into the water.
There'll be a post under there.
Oh.
Or actually, no, it won't be a post under there. We'll make a steel cantilever tray that will hold the deck.
Probably.
I'm talking about tree protection.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, pardon me.
So, tree protection and construction fencing are on your T2, and I changed it since Rick came in and had some comments, so fencing has changed on this already, so what we're trying to do is create workspaces that will protect the trees and give people a good staging area. What you see on here is tree protection fencing where there's going to be equipment. There's not tree protection fencing in the garden itself because we're going to be working around those trees and showing root pruning on them. And that will probably be, there will probably be more of that coming up as soon as I do try to work the grading plan out. We'll probably have a little bit more root pruning.
But this is part of what we would start soon, is this root pruning, especially for the trees that are going to be transplanted. Yeah.
Carrie, can I ask, have you dealt with the public? We've dealt with public with some heat around some of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I would expect that there'll be some people who, once it starts happening, we're doing whatever, maybe speaking up. Have you dealt with that?
Oh, I've dealt with that before.
Yeah. I know you have as individuals.
So, well, one of the things is we need to get construction fencing around this whole thing before we start any demo. And I don't consider transplanting demo. But once we start taking down trees, we start ripping up sidewalk, the garden's going to be closed until we're done from that point. And I think, one of the, we need to be sensitive of how things look and everything. So that's why having the fence up would be really good. We don't need people walking through the middle of it while it's happening for safety and the way it's going to look. But when the clusters of trees come down, it's gonna look a little bare in there for a little while.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I should say too is that, so this plan, these plans all kind of got done in a really fast process, got finished last week. To go out and actually look at the trees and figure out things will shift again based on reality and how the root pruning goes and where some of these trees are going to have roots that are way above grade. And
right.
They have to be careful with them. So.
And you said they would be transplanted not in the park?
They don't need to.
Not in the Japanese garden?
Not in the Japanese garden.
Right.
Because of the construction, I think it would be better for the trees to just go in the ground somewhere.
Would that
sooner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our staff is working right now to find places for two of them. We already know where one is going to go if it's even possible to transplant that one. We're gonna give it our best effort.
Which hazel?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's awfully broad.
Yeah. So we're still gonna give it a shot, but the other two, Mike and his crew are working on where those can go.
So,
yeah, sure.
I don't see, I mean, I was advocating for this to be moved somewhat that way. But it seems to me that if you just do something like this, just eliminate that fence, because there's no work that even happens in that.
Okay. You mean this fence back here?
The one on the sidewalk.
This fence here.
Oh.
Because, I mean, the work goes here. It should go across there, because all that can be outside of the structure.
So we cut in between 51 and 52 or something like that.
Right. Okay.
And then, it might save us a couple hundred feet.
Exactly. Save some fencing. And again, I don't think we want to block up any more of the park than we have to.
Okay.
And I like the idea, Kerry, before the meeting, talking about around tree 68, I guess it is, just having the fence.
Yeah, so that's what I did. I just kind of excluded all of that.
That to me.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are...
Kerry, can you show me what you just showed him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you see where 68, how...
Yeah, right there. So we're coming around.
So this whole area is just not in the zone.
And we're not going to chip it anymore either?
I don't think we need to. If we keep the equipment out of there, we don't need to.
If it's fenced away, it shouldn't need it.
We're going to need access to that area right there, though, because the wall comes up. Something like that.
Okay.
What I'm trying to advocate for is that we have the smallest area possible to start with for the area that's the construction open area for mobilization and storing and moving equipment. But I do understand that if we do make it small, there needs to be flexibility. And the way I would recommend would be flexibility to just say, okay, this is a small area, this is what we want, but if all of a sudden they can't turn a piece of equipment around, they don't have to go to the park, they can just go to the parks director and he's allowed to make any changes needed there.
I think it's a great idea. Kerry,
yes.
You know, I don't think we're showing all the trees that Toru had envisioned outside of the garden. Did
you mean planted?
Yeah, planted, new plantings. He had some cherry trees and things like that. And I think that was one of the neat things about his plan was he kind of had some... he had a spread out kind of drawing your eye towards the garden with some trees that are actually outside of the garden.
Yeah, I think I've got kind of focused.
Yeah, that's... I just want to make sure we don't lose that. That was one of the cool things.
Okay.
And what is a Sukiyama style garden? On the north side, northeast.
Well,
there's something labeled as a...
Yeah. You... Not ask me because I haven't researched it yet.
Okay. So I can tell you that this is the garden that replaced the bamboo garden. So the theme of this garden is just that there are some boulders in there. There's a path walking through. There's a hand washing station as you come in, and at least two fountains, lanterns in that area. It's got a small bamboo fence that separates it from the main path, but basically it's those two dug firs with a walking path through there and some placement of boulders and some other vegetative material with those other things I talked about. And I'm sure Toru can explain exactly what it is, but that's the intent of that garden.
I will be able to explain it, but I can't.
I can't see that, right?
So it looks like that pathway terminates at this geometric something, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sprocket, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Sprocket, pathway, pathway. Yeah.
That's the way the plan was. There was a way in, like there's little paths in that not a big platform there.
And what's a sprocket?
It's a lantern.
That's a lantern. So I'm pretty sure about a sprocket.
It's a gear. It's a cog, actually. Yeah, it's a cog.
It's for gearheads that want to hang and park.
So, yeah, those are lanterns.
I see what you're asking. Yeah, so I think there'll also be a little path in, I'm not sure.
From the wash station area.
There. Yeah, to the side of the wash station. But
yeah.
I think they're supposed to be really subtle.
And not ADA.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Not to the
standard of ADA.
Hill garden.
Hill or hill?
Hill.
So, just to clarify, this was informational today.
This is informational, yeah. I'm letting you know that we're ready to start the first phase, which is going to be completed by a contractor who will come in and do the transplanting for us. And then the second part of the first phase, phase 1B, I guess you could say, is the demo, which will start in the next 2 months.
Maybe my memory's not serving me well, but what I remember was that you were to come back with a tree preservation plan for us to approve.
Was it for you to approve?
I thought so.
Well, here it is.
Special meeting.
We can advertise it for the next meeting if that's what was actually in the motion. I don't.
If it is, then I think we should. If it isn't, it doesn't. I just want us to follow what we said to.
Okay, we'll do some research into that. We'll make sure whatever needs to happen happens. But this is the tree protection plan. And if we need to bring it back for an official motion, we will.
But we talked about making some changes to it tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those changes will be made. So.
But does it include moving slightly away that line that's parallel to the Doug Furs? Does it include moving up people on those?
What do you? Yes.
The construction.
Yeah. The construction.
Yeah. So where the chips are now, I think that's where Carrie drew the new fence.
So I drew it on here. And I'll change it.
Okay.
Yeah, so where the edge of the chips are right now.
That's such a big area. At least that far.
We can make it work.
You know, if you think about needing to move things right. And mm-hmm. equipment moving around and stuff, you don't want to make it so tight that people can't function.
Understood. But it's too big.
Then they'll trash
it. They'll use it all.
So we've got all the boulders that are in here that need to be pulled out and stored. There's things like that. And trust me, I'm not an advocate for letting people with big machinery tear things up. But I also don't want them to be frustrated in the process.
I appreciate your awareness.
So, okay, a couple other things really quick. We have our staff working on a plan to remove the tea house, which needs a new home. Mike and his staff are working on finding a new home for the tea house.
Put it in my backyard.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people are thinking that.
I think the pickleball court should be.
Yeah. So Mike already had a couple of options. I think they're gonna look at another couple.
A dog park.
Yeah.
A shelter.
Then they'll expect everything to be built to that standard. So.
I just make the bench about 12 inches instead of 24.
Yeah. So we're looking at that. So we can see that coming out around the same time that we get started with demo and everything. So, and just FYI, we are not planning on driving full-size dump trucks into this area. I don't believe the slope allows us to. So we have a drive area coming in that we're going to be fully chipping. In fact, they're going to do that this week, and that will be the entrance point and probably the staging point for equipment, as opposed to trying to drive down in there. They might not ever get that back out.
One other thing, I think there needs to be signage. I would think, 2 or 3 weeks before anything happens.
Well, I would agree with demo. I don't think we need to put up signage for transplanting a few trees.
No, that's not what signage would be. The signage is just, hey, in the next few weeks or next month, construction's going to be done on Japanese Garden. It's a major renovation. And just kind of to give people an idea so that people don't just show up and go, what happened?
Yeah, so what we'll do is we'll shoot for a two to three week period, where we do a social media campaign and an on-the-site sign campaign, letting people know. That will be prior to the closure of the garden. The garden closes the day that the fence gets put up, and we start pulling out sidewalk and the other major pieces. So.
And there'll be a different set of signage at that point on the fence side.
It'll be brought to you by your friendly Ashland Parks and Recreation Commissioners. So,
how about, is there going to be a sign that states like when directed in?
Yeah. So we'll come up with some sort of informational signage that's
not financed by public money.
Yes. We'll probably have to put up a couple signs in a couple different places. We're also considering putting up screening on the fencing.
So you can't see him.
So it's harder to see him. Yeah. So we're considering
a Japanese motif.
Yeah, probably. So we're considering that as well. It's a cost issue, so we'll look at that. But definitely we'll want to take every opportunity we have to keep people as informed as possible. It's not me, I promise.
And am I correct in assuming that commissioners, with the guide of Jason or somebody, can occasionally take a walk through?
So you'll want to contact me on this project.
Okay.
And I'll be working with Carrie and the project manager on site and our staff. But yeah, if just please just come through me.
Yeah. And I seem like we're quite winding down, but I did want to say that I appreciate the effort on these plans. There's a lot of information here, and it does ground it in reality a lot further. So we've really made some progress here. I appreciate the work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I can say we would not be moving forward right now were it not for us taking this path and Carrie being available and doing all this work. She's really come to bat for us. So. All right, so we will check out as far as if there's any process issues with moving forward. We are planning on the tree transplantation happening as soon as we can get contracts finalized, which hopefully will be in the next 2 weeks. It will be in the next 2 weeks. We are also looking at some tree pruning in that time as well, which could happen as early as this week. But no garden closures. We're not cutting down any trees, anything like that, or taking out any amenities now. That'll all happen after the fence goes up and after the campaign of information goes out. So.
Do you want to keep this one?
Sure. Yes, I'd love to keep that.
I'm gonna take this because I
have
enough time.
All right. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you, Carrie.
Oh, you haven't looked for it.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, we'll move on to item number 2 under unfinished business, which is park hours rules. Once again, this has information.
I think that one's mine.
And that one's yours?
Yeah. I think
okay. See you later, Jim.
See you, Jim. So
happy birthday to your son.
Yeah. So I think we put this one before the alcohol ordinance because this one is so much easier. So, but we're going to talk about both of them. The park hours have a list of suggested rules, and this is a starting point. This is for discussion. We're not asking you to vote on anything tonight. When Rachel comes up, it'll be the same thing with the alcohol ordinance amendment. But the things, I went back through my notes and I took out the one about the golf course, which seemed to.
Regarding alcohol? Or?
No, we're talking about park hours. So on the second page, it starts with vehicular traffic. These would be the exceptions to to the closure. So let me just go back a little bit. So what the new ordinance would say is that nobody's allowed in parks between the hours of 12 a.m., which is midnight, and 5 a.m., except for official business, which is by us, or as authorized by the Ashland Parks and Recreation Commission, consistent with established parks rules and regulations. So those rules and regulations are what we need to start talking about. I've got a list of six that we've kind of gleaned from other agencies, things that they put in. Band is one of them. There's a few others that we looked at. But the first one is, if you have a vehicle and you're driving up Winburn Way, you're not violating the park rules by driving up a public street. I can't think of actually, through the golf course, that's a public street through the golf course. If you drive through there after park hours, that's not violating the park rules either, the park hour rules. Persons attending, participating in, going to, or coming from an activity, either programmed or scheduled by APRC, or under a permit issued by the same. So what this would be is if we have an event going on, like movies in the park, it just happens to go till 12:30. If you're coming or going or at that after 12, and it's something that we're putting on, or it's something that was put on through a permit issued by us, then you're not violating parks rules. And that's coming and going and being at that. A person may enter a closed park to retrieve valuables they left behind, or a vehicle that they may have parked in the upper parking lot by our office or something like that. If what you're doing is coming in to get that vehicle and leaving, or you forgot something of value, or doesn't have to be the traditional sense of value, but you know, a sippy cup or something left at one of the tables, you can come back in and grab it. You wouldn't be violating park rules if you did that.
But you can't camp while you're waiting for
your vehicle. You can't camp. You can't establish a base camp while you're looking for the sippy cup. Yeah, no, you can't do that. All right, pedestrians may travel through a park on their way to somewhere. So if you enter the park, and this goes to trails and parks aren't just recreation, they're transportation if you use it to get from point A to point B. So we don't want to close down transportation routes because of park hours. So what this is really saying is if you're on a path, you can move through a park as long as you keep moving. I mean, that's the suggestion here is that, I mean, literally, if you're going, it's you who decides what point A and point B are. If one of them is not outside the park and going through the park gets you closer to the other one, then that's a transportation route. Let's see, park staff and emergency responders. I think that's obvious that we can enter and do what we need to do. It's actually even mentioned in the ordinance itself. And then just to, as kind of a catch-all, and I don't know that this is the catch-all, but we mentioned permit earlier. We could mention it again. Special events is kind of nebulous, but for instance, one of the things I think we could expand is if Shakespeare, for instance, it's not one of our productions, but if you're getting out of Shakespeare and walking down the stairs and walking through the park, that shouldn't be.
But that's you're going through.
Transportation, yeah, okay. And then other activities approved by the director of APRC. And I put that in there because if you've ever watched the show Parks and Recreation, there's a group that comes out for the end of the world every couple of years, right? And they camp in the park. And so if somebody was like, hey, there's a comet, hey, there's a special thing going on, I think it should be within my purview to grant a permit for people to do something. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibilities that there would be a legitimate use that happens after midnight in rare circumstances. And I think that it would be onerous for the groups to have to come all the way to the commission to ask for permission to do that. I think I should be able to do that. So that's why I put that in there. So
Just a small suggestion. It seems like if you put in pedestrians may travel through a park to a destination outside of park property, it seems like you might want to actually just literally say they need to keep moving.
Okay.
I mean, you know, anybody could be standing in the park saying, well, I am going to a destination outside of the park.
Okay. That's a good point.
It's just going to take me a while.
All right, yeah.
Okay.
I don't.
As long as you're trying to prevent people from camping in the park.
Okay. Okay, so I got that one. We need to work on some language that says as long as you've got forward momentum,
how about
you keep
continuous
moving.
Continuous travel.
Continuous travel. I like that. Continuous travel.
Traveling.
I like that. Okay.
Mr. Juan.
I think these are good. And I do have, of course, a few things.
Oh.
A couple of things. Number one, I think including Windward Way, there's no reason to
okay.
put that language in there. Vehicular traffic crossing a public roadway through a park, period. That it's definitive, and I think it's almost confusing because Windward Way, part of Windward Way, is not through the park, and it just, it isn't, I don't think it adds any clarity by having that. Then I have a question. Up in the actual ordinance, it says, except for city officials. So that means we are not city officials. Is that what we're saying? The park staff is not city officials?
No, let's see. I'm surprised that actually got past us. I think it was supposed to say APRC or city officials.
Okay. And then
because we usually do make a distinction.
Yeah.
So.
That sounds fine. Then for five, then I would just say, sorry, emergency response may and associated. Just take the park staff and off.
Okay.
But I think the list is pretty thorough.
Good. Any other comments?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, I will. We're taking this at the same time as the other rule, getting them both finished at the same time, so we don't take two ordinance amendments to the council at different times. So I will have a chance to show these to you again in a meeting where you can approve them. Which should be coming up in the next month or so. So, thank you.
Okay. Next, we will have the alcohol and parks rules. Now the fun begins. Superintendent Giles.
Thank you. I've been asked to bring back rules and guidelines for the commission to discuss tonight regarding alcohol in the park areas. What you have in front of you is a memo that shows the current ordinance with the suggested language that will go to the council as a package down the road. one of the first things you'll see is the existing exemption where alcohol is allowed in the current ordinance, and those include the extension between in Lithia Park between Ashland Creek, or sorry, North Main Street and Winburn Way between Ashland Creek and the plaza to the east. Alcohol is also allowed in the portion of the park that's leased to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Alcohol is allowed on the Cay Guanajuato, and it has to be served with prepared meals as part of the lease agreement that we have with the restaurant on the Cay.
Are you saying that someone can't have a drink on the Cay at the restaurant?
They can.
Okay.
This is where alcohol is allowed.
Right, but you said it's part of prepared meal, and people just, I go out for a beer at Louis sitting on the side. Or did you say it's part of
the establishment just has to serve.
Right. Yeah,
that's right. That's
too,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And then the last one would be alcohol is allowed if it was on golf course. So basically, I've looked at guidelines and rules. I've kind of done a lot of research in my little file here. But basically, what I'm looking at is the rules and guidelines as a whole, and not just a piecemeal, like, you know, just kind of picking and choosing. I'm looking at what's going to make the most sense, what's going to be reasonable and as little impact as possible to the park area at this time. So something starting small and then maybe looking at expanding it down the road, but starting reasonably. So the first recommendation was look at the locations. So the three locations that we've come up with at this point that make the most sense are the Butler Banshell area, which is by the Parassi Fountain area and Sycamore Grove. So these areas are kind of all connected because when someone does an event in the park, they're kind of utilizing all of those areas. The second area was the Feast of Will Lawn, which is the lawn between the Lower Duck Pond and the Children's Playground. And the third area will be the Ice Rink parking lot on Windblown Bay.
I wanted to clarify that language a little bit because I assume we wouldn't allow alcohol when the ice skating rink was in operation, correct? I think that's a really cool idea.
But
do you really want to limit it?
You're thinking of the ice rink parking lot area as more of it could be an event area for, like, maybe, I guess, for instance, if the Siskiyou Challenge was doing, you know.
Yeah, you mean just being part of when it's being used as part of
Yeah. That's the language kind of says that, but mm-hmm. I'd like that to be a little clearer because I don't think it would make any sense at all to serve alcohol when people are skating.
So the Windburn Way parking lot.
You're not from the Midwest, are you? There's a lot of tradition involved here.
Mm-hmm. It used to be.
But
it's very typical.
Okay. You're saying when it's a parking lot.
Yeah.
When it's not the ice rink.
When it's not the ice rink.
Because it could still be closed off from being a parking lot after the ice rink's done.
Yeah. I only care that we don't serve alcohol at the ice skating rink while the people are skating.
Gotcha. Yeah, I agree.
So what about, Rachel, I didn't bring this up because I guess we're still kind of in the middle of figuring out the Japanese garden, but I wonder if the Japanese garden would be a place where, I think the Japanese garden will be a place where receptions happen in the future. I wonder if that's one we should consider as well.
Is there a big enough place to have a reception?
It's right adjacent to the Sycamore Grove.
It is, and it would be... I believe that there are places.
Is it going to be fenced off?
There's going to be fenced off.
Okay.
Yeah. I would maybe put a question mark next to that one. Maybe.
I would like to talk to Karu about that, you know, about traditions of Japanese gardens and alcohol. I'd like to know if they have stamps on that myself. And also, my question was, are those the areas that get leased for weddings that you've mentioned already?
So what we're talking about right now is... these are areas that are mostly used for events, and because the way that we were trying to limit start small, which is basically to start with a 501c3 event, and then maybe down the road if things are going well, add in things like weddings, but starting smaller, just seeing how it goes.
Well, I would like to put the Japanese garden into that consider adding later. I think that's a significant thing to consider, and I can't jump on that myself.
I just have a technical question. Mm-hmm. Isn't the Feast of Will Lawn, isn't that known as the Roper Grove?
The what Grove?
Roper Grove.
I don't.
Traditionally? Or is it more known as the Feast of Will Lawn?
I think we had a if there is a traditional name, I'd rather it's used that.
Well, that was the name from the Chautauqua, was the Roper Grove.
I'll find out what the traditional name is and I can add that in.
Because I was just wondering, what if the Feast of Will doesn't hold it there, but holds mm-hmm. it somewhere else, like at the... Mm-hmm. Well, I guess if it held it at the band show or someplace, it would be covered under this. But
I think you make a good point, though. Feast of Will is an event that happens every year, and people might know that, oh, that's the lawn where the Feast of Will is currently held. Mm-hmm. But I think you got a good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Moving on to number two, only events where OLCC permit is required will be allowed within Lydia Park and the designated areas. And cut. The reason for that is to just make it as stringent as possible to begin with. So an event where alcoholic beverages will be sold, a licensed service is being sold, or the event host is charging or accepting donations of goods for admission, so that sort of thing.
I'm sorry, what? Only event, is this, you're talking about number two, right?
Yeah, licensed service. What defines licensed service? Oh. By the LLCC. Where you're going to have to get an LLCC permit.
Oh.
Yeah. If you turn the page and look at the next, so the applicant must be a 501c3, and that gives you the designation of what a 501c3 is, and then nonprofit events. The applicant must be at least 21 years of age, and then the approval permit allows you for possession of beer and wine only, because it's a, beer and wine is easier than requiring hard liquor.
Is that an LLCC?
I think that's an LLCC.
Like
I think it's a distinction. Yeah, I know that the golf course, we've kind of talked about golf course only serves beer and wine right now. If they wanted to expand their liquor license, they'd have to go through another process for that.
So it's a separate license for
hard liquor. It's an expanded license or something. So the special event application and detailed site plan, we want to do at least 60 days prior to the event. One of the things that that I was looking at City of Medford, what City of Medford does for events with that have alcohol, is actually provide a map of the consumption area with entry points, like where people are entering, where they're exiting. And then they actually require, City of Medford requires 4-foot fencing to go around the area where people are consuming alcohol.
That's not in here.
It's not here yet. I just actually found that today when I was looking at it. So
actually, I think it makes, I don't really understand the language about a tent and all that. I think really all you want is an enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
I just take out all the language about a canopy, tent, because why do you have to have that in the summer when it's in a shaded location?
Mm-hmm.
What's the point? But the enclosure, it seems like that's the key.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that what 7 says? If he must be consumed within an enclosure as agreed upon by APRC.
No, 7 says alcohol must, am I reading the wrong one?
No, it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't say it has to be a canopy. It just lists some options.
No, I'm just saying if you take out under a canopy shelter within a tent, and just use the beginning and the end of that.
I agree.
That's basically what you're saying, is you have to have some enclosure. And you don't, you'll just tell the permitter what it needs to be when they get the permit.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that we would like for them to have a fence rather than just a canopy with no fence.
I'm saying that, I mean, I would say, I think what we're discussing is the need for a canopy or shelter really that important? More, it's an enclosure so the alcohol is consumed, it's sold into one place that people can't just freely go in and out of.
Mm-hmm.
Or they maybe can go freely in and out, but it's a designated area where they can consume the alcohol.
As opposed to when it worked out at the golf course last summer.
Yeah, where you go anywhere.
Oh, that's true, because we don't
You can drink anywhere at the golf course.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's duly noted. I can make that change. Oh, and then actually Medford also, it has to be a fencing. It can't be like any rope or taped area. It has to be an enclosure or fence. Some kind of fencing. The insurance requirement, and that is standard City of Ashland language requirement. The permit can only be valid for the identified purpose and date. Do you have a question?
Well, I just think there's a bit of redundancy there, I think, because it says insurance is required to consume alcohol. Consume alcohol on city option property.
There's two things there.
But then it says if alcohol is being sold or any type of charged at an event, blah, 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 blah. insurance is required. Mm-hmm. But we've already said above that that's the only way you get a permit is if you are charging for it. So I don't know why it has to be in there because we already know that's the situation. So basically, in order to get a permit, insurance is required, mm-hmm. and then liquor liability insurance. Well, actually, just to start maybe there. Forget everything up until cost it out, and then liquor liability insurance is required.
We should probably start. Probably start the first sentence with general liability insurance is required. And then
it says two certificates here, though. So
there are two certificates. One is a general liability insurance, and one is a liquor liability insurance.
I don't see anything in here about general liability.
That's the first sentence.
Although it's not all that clear.
Yeah, I know.
Like I said, general insurance.
It says liquor liability insurance.
I'll rework that then.
Yeah, that's what it refers to.
It distinguishes between, like, if you were giving alcohol away, you just had alcohol, but you were giving it to the people there, or if you were actually charging them to have it.
Actually, it would be, if you're doing general liability insurance, that would just be for an event then where you're not serving
that's
alcohol.
Right.
If you're having an event where you're serving alcohol, you would have to have general liability and the liquor liability.
Yeah.
So I'll rework that.
On the Feast of Will, they don't put up a fence, historically. They might put a line up. Mm-hmm. Did we suddenly say they had to have a fence?
I just said that we want to have an area of consumption when people are consuming alcohol.
Okay.
So some kind of enclosure.
Good. Okay, I'm fine with that. I just didn't suddenly want to do a fence with that discussion.
Yeah. So that would be around their whole facility if they were going to sell wine to have with their meal, right?
They also have to satisfy OLCC. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just that. So OLCC will have other requirements. So,
mm-hmm.
And they could say it has to be a fence.
So, Rachel, how come you got the easy way to get a part of it?
I don't know.
Because she's smarter.
So glass containers are not permitted. The permit holder must have a copy of the permit. All these things are kind of like general things that I've seen throughout other agencies. This is the one that the permit will not be issued for event hours prior to 11 a.m. or later than 8 p.m. I think limiting it is probably better. And I don't think, Shakespeare happens right there, starting at 8 o'clock, I think, cutting things off right at 8 o'clock, 11 o'clock seems reasonable for, that's when most restaurants open and start serving wine and beer, so. Seems reasonable.
I'd be curious who's serving before 5 o'clock
somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then permits are issued on a first come, first served basis, dependent on availability of park areas and conflicts with other uses. So if we had something else going on, maybe if there was a already previously booked wedding or something like that that was close to the band shell, we would be mindful. We as staff would be mindful of that and either ask them to move schedule, different hours or move their date.
For non-alcoholic, it seems like some of this stuff would be the same as for non-alcoholic
mm-hmm.
events.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't you just delete the ones that are the same and just say and all and just refer to the other events?
Well, I think there is advantage if someone's taking out a permit for alcohol events to know what all the rules are on one place rather than having to look at park regulations elsewhere myself.
So if that's the case, then have you gone over the when you created this list? Did you go over the other events?
Yeah, we have a special event application that we work with. So this one just being expanded. This would be part of our special event application that we just expand these guidelines into, and probably this helps us with our special events as well. It helps us kind of dial in a little bit better in asking questions of the person who's renting for it. Fees. One more quick thing that I just wanted to point out, number 15, the depending on the size and impact of event, additional parameters may be set by HRC, and then I put it including security. One thing that I did today when I was reviewing City of Medford, actually for any events that they have where alcohol is served, they actually require security. And they require you to list what security company you're going with and the phone number of the security company. I'm not bought into the fact that I think maybe all of our events have to have security for serving alcohol, but I think it's something that it should be in there in case that we as staff are, I mean, depending on the size of the event.
I think there might be an issue trying to have staff make a determination.
Mm-hmm.
But I like where you're going with it, because we know that the police department said they'll work with us on whatever we come up with, but they did have concerns. Mm-hmm. And this might be a way to alleviate some of those concerns.
Required security.
Yeah.
Well, it says may require security.
But we're talking about... We're talking about... What I think is that if we keep it at May, how do we determine, where's that threshold where we say?
You might set a number, you know, like,
well, maybe
100 people.
But see, I think that's what it should be. Rather than May, it should be, you should have some parameters.
Yeah, as long as it is a parameter, then that we could work with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, it's going to be, let's say a gay pride event came up, and we know there's going to be a lot of people there. But we require them to have, therefore, we require them to have security. Some other group, like the Feast of Will, we didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, we're accused of discrimination.
Yeah, so if you...
I mean, Medford just says that alcohol is served, private security guards are required. And then it just says security company name, the phone number, and then number of security guards present. So, I mean, we could set a threshold and say, you know, depending on the amount of people, this many security guards. I mean, I could talk to Pat, I could talk to the police chief about it too.
If that's the case, then one of the things you need to have an application is project the number of people.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say 99.
So yeah, I think as long as there is a clear standard,
mm-hmm,
where it is... there's a criteria, we can implement the criteria without having to make any judgment call, you know, on what's required, what should have it, what shouldn't have it. It is, you either need it or you don't need it.
Mm-hmm. So jumping to fees, obviously the direction from the commission was that there should be a financial benefit beyond cost recovery.
You mean to the commission, by the way, right? Not the department.
Right. The direction, yeah, the direction from the Parks Commission at the last meeting.
Well, to the organization. To the organization.
The commission is the organization.
It is the organization.
Okay, the direction from the commissioners at the last meeting was that this should be a financial benefit beyond cost recovery.
Right. What I'm saying is that the way, at least as I understand the way you have written this, the fees for allowance of alcohol should both cover both admin and facility staff time and should be a financial, mm-hmm, benefit to the department. Do you mean the department?
It's just APRC. Well, but to me, I don't know what that means. Does that mean that we meet that as long as we get a dollar over our cost?
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes back to the discussion we just had on the previous one, and I think Rachel had talked about setting some thresholds, or I think that's what we want to talk about,
right,
is setting some thresholds where, you know, if you have something of this size, it's this fee. If you have something of that size, it's that fee, and do it that way.
And acknowledge that this is an experiment, and we can't know, you know, right the first time we do it, how much,
mm-hmm,
we're going to measure.
You know, what I was going to mention tonight is that, you know, currently, right now, we have a special event application fee. And we know, right now, we've been charging a special event application fee of $25. And sometimes, it takes us 10 minutes to review, not a big deal, it slides through, it's fine. Other times, it might take us a couple hours to, you know, we have to meet with the applicant, go through a process. So the first fee that I would recommend that we establish, or actually to raise, would be the special event fee, regardless of alcohol or not. You know, going, having a special event fee go from $25 to $100 for the application review, for a meeting with staff. And then if you're serving alcohol, there's another fee on top of that. And I don't know what amount of staff time is going to, what's going to be required. I think it's going to depend on the event. But I think a low end for a fee would be about $300. And, you know, high end, maybe $500. I just, until we can, you know, really get into the, you know, meat of the event, I just don't know what the staff time amount is going to be.
My sense is one of the primary time factors is all the work you're doing right now. You know, you're coming up with all these rules and regulations that you obviously put some time into.
This is our job.
That's why we're getting
here. Exactly.
No, I'm supporting that.
Exactly right.
But what I'm saying is, I think it is hard to clarify how much, since it's something we haven't done very often, how much time is going to be involved in an alcohol-related fee. So, you know, I wouldn't.
I mean, and it's not only, you know, bottom line is once we get into this, the long-term event coordinator, Suleiman, is going to be the one that's going to be first, you know, kind of mostly be dealing with these applications. But it's not only his time, it's going to be on-site, like, facility staff, you know, day of event. You know, if we have to go and check the permit, if we have to, like, count people, you know, it just depends on how in the weeds we're going to get to know what the cost is going to be.
Real quick. So we're discussing, these would be park rules, right?
Yeah.
So after City Council takes our recommendation on new alcohol in parks discussion, or then we can change the park rules anytime we want.
That's true.
To basically one notice general business meeting.
That's true.
So I find that to be less cumbersome if we come up with what we think right now is the right number, like $100 for a special permit and $50 an hour for something else, you know, if that's what it's going to be, and just put that in. And then if something takes 3 hours, you know, it's $150. If it takes 5 hours, it's $250, you know. It's like we establish what it's going to be, and then, you know, we really just want to recover a reasonable amount for the effort that we put in.
I think a base fee charge is better. I mean, as far as, like, we'll do an application fee, but then just a base fee of, like, say $300, because that's going to cover, that hopefully would cover, more than cover our staff time. Because if we're just saying we're going to charge people $50 an hour based on how much staff time we do,
yeah,
we're charging them after, and then they, you know, might argue with us, and I think it's much easier just to charge the base fee.
So we used to charge, in another city, I was in charge of the engineering division, and we charged by the hour for plan reviews based on how much time the engineer spent on the plans. And it's just, it ends up being an argument a lot more often than you'd think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just so much straightforward to use a base fee, understanding that maybe if we can get a fee that will capture most of the time that we spend on most of the applications. There might be one or two here and there that we spend a little bit more time on. I think that's okay.
So Julian and Rick and then Joel.
Do we know how much, I don't know if anybody knows, how much revenue the festival will actually collect? Do we know anything about any of that stuff?
No. I don't.
And I think it's probably not something we need to know.
Yeah, I don't know that it's relevant.
Here's my reason behind asking that. So, because there's a reason. So it seems like they are a charity organization. They are fundraising when they, you know, put on these events, and the event is for the purpose of, you know, benefiting the city in some way. Well, that's what we do as well. So, I mean, we are sort of in the same business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's helpful to them for us to make it, you know, easier for them to do their work. But it seems that it would also make sense for them to make this work for this park, for the Parks and Recreation Department as well. Because, you know, part of the reason that we're even considering doing these things is an effort to ensure the financial stability of the park system for the benefit of the residents of Ashland. And so, I mean, they're sort of the same goals, so I don't think it's unreasonable they're similar goals for the similar reasons, but I don't think it's unreasonable to have a sense of what they are generating in terms of revenue, and for us to sort of base our fee for the use of the residents of Ashland's park for that purpose, on that number. But anyhow, that's my reasoning behind that.
But we don't want to have a separate fee for every event.
No,
we're trying to standardize it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The Feast of World is kind of like a standard. I mean, come on. I don't know that every event is going to be exactly the same size as the Feast of World.
Well, and that's the problem, is that not every event. Not every event is going to be the same, and not every 501c3 is going to be, the same. There's all kinds of charitable organizations.
I know, but if they're having an event where they're serving alcohol, they're fundraising, right?
Yeah, I mean, they do have to charge admission. I mean, the rules say they have to charge admission. Generally speaking, yeah, I mean, they don't. I mean, it doesn't say. Well, but it doesn't say that this has to, that they, we have to see that the money that they're making there goes back, I mean, we don't know that they're...
I'm not suggesting that we have to audit their books either. That's not what I'm saying. Well, it should be public information, so it shouldn't be hard.
Is it public information? No.
501c3 donations and contributions?
No.
Not for small amounts at fundraising events.
Well, all right. I'm not saying that we need to go in there and audit their books in detail. I'm just, as a general sense, it seems like we should be able to, proportion our fee based on the total amount of revenue that they are expecting to generate.
And I have to say, as a staff, as a representative staff, from our perspective, I think our fee should be based on the actual and projected time that we would put into something, not the actual, the projected time that we would put into something, what that cost is, plus a reasonable amount to make it a revenue venture for Ashland Parks and Recreation.
But isn't this fee that same thing? I mean, isn't it staff time and then, a stipend or whatever you want to call it, that provides some financial support to make sure that the park system is financially stable into the future? I mean, isn't it all the one fee?
No, there's two fees. There's two fees.
And I don't think we know. I mean, I think I have a good guess as to how much time I think it's going to take with our staff and the facility staff. But I feel comfortable saying low end 300 plus the $100 special event fee. But I can't tell you for sure. I mean, there could be an event that happens that we end up spending way more time on, and then we have to go back and evaluate it again because.
Well, the hope would be that there would be events that took a lot of time, and events that took time,
there's an agency at the City of Vancouver, Parks and Recreation. They have four different rates, and I don't want to get really complicated about rates because I think that it's confusing for people. But they have it split out, pretty well. They've got a rate one, which is events up to 100 people, and it gives you these are the things that you can do within this rate. And then rate two is over 100 people. With these, you can do these things. All the way up to rate four, which includes you can have a fence and you can have served alcohol. And you have to pay a deposit of $200. You got to pay $525 up front, and there's a special event fee. And that's
the 500
alcohol and fencing.
So the $525 isn't being charged to the other groups if they're not doing alcohol.
No, if somebody's doing, rate number three is if somebody's doing an event that's over 100 people and you're taking entry fees, but you're not serving alcohol, maybe you're having vendors, you're utilizing additional space, I don't know exactly what that means, you have entry fees, that rate is $400, and that's over 100 people. And then if you rate two, if you are doing a public or exclusive event with over 100 people and you have not utilizing so much space, you have vendors, you don't have alcohol, it's $200. So there's these incremental. But the reason I say let's start with $300 and $100 application fee And then let's evaluate it in a year down the road and see, does that work? Or do we need to make our fees, I mean, maybe it's working really well, because like, we're going to expand it and we're going to add another fee, we're going to change the fees and add another fee for weddings or, you know, something else. Mm-hmm. But starting really basic, I think, is important.
Mr. Wong, and then...
Sorry, I didn't mean to go on tangent.
No, that was good.
We have a lot of fees that are really complicated.
Let's see. Listen to this conversation. I don't have a lot of confidence that this is going to be a revenue producer. And if that's the case, I really want to go out and do it. $100 plus $300. I just don't know why we're doing it.
If that's the way everybody feels, let us know, because Rachel's spending a lot of time on this, and you know.
So it's similar to all the other activities we undertake, like the ice skating rink, the pool, the whatever. We are charging the citizens a fee. We're charging the residents a fee to maintain the space that is theirs. And it seems that this kind of falls into the same sort of category. In those other things, it's a significant fee for the maintenance of Lithia Park. That we, you know, the equivalent, I guess I would say, is that we would theoretically charge a fee for the use of Lithia Park, which is what we are offering, or that's our product that we're selling. And we would charge a fee that would be sort of a similar proportionality. I mean, I suppose nobody's going to pay for the maintenance of the entire park, exactly, but it would have some meaningful impact on the cost of maintaining the park. I mean, that's like if you looked at the swimming pool or the ice skating rink, there is similarity.
It'd be so hard to come up with a good number, and it would be such a small percentage that you'd just look at it and go, it's not worth it. Because we can come up with what it costs to take care of an acre of Lithia Park, but generally, and taking care of an acre of a park is around $30,000 a year, somewhere in that range. And so you take that to Lithia Park standard, and who knows? It could be it could be 1.5 to 2 times that, 20 to 30,000 per acre. But and then breaking it down and prorating that down to the hour, you know, it'd be, or the impact or whatever it is, it'd be an interesting process.
Well, in that case, it's still a benefit to the Feast of Will, and that is a benefit to the city, because they, you know, do charitable work for the city, which the city appreciates and the residents appreciate. So,
but I would caution against approving this for the Feast of Will, because we can't limit it to the Feast of Will.
What I'm saying is, if it's a 501c3 organization, and presumably a charity organization is trying to do something for, in this case, maybe the benefit of the city, we hope Feast of Will or whoever it is. And so, you know, it's still a value to the city, to the residents of the city, because they are supporting the city in an indirect kind of a way. So I think it's still worth allowing or liberalizing the alcohol policy in the park, even if we're not making, you know, even if we're not helping actually with the financial stability of the park, let's say. But even in that situation, I think it's still worth making the alcohol policy more inclusive, or giving people the option of having alcohol in different places in the park. Yes.
Joel, and then I'll go.
Can I clarify a kid's birthday party? They have to make reservations for it, right? Usually.
Depending. If there's someone just coming to use the park, they can just come use the park. But if they want an area, a reservable area, then with the park, they would have to reserve it ahead of time.
And is
and
that
pay a fee.
And is that the special event fee?
No, that is if you just want to come and use a picnic shelter or something like that, you just pay the reservation fee for a 4-hour period of time, and you get that.
I just wanted to make sure that
anybody can come and use the park, except for when there's certain areas that are permitted areas you can pay for and reserve for a certain amount of time.
Right. But reserving a place doesn't make it a special event.
No. Okay. Reserving a place requires a special event application for doing something outside of normal use of that area.
I'm sorry, it sounded, in other words, an event beyond a birthday party, a gathering of friends, or whatever. That's okay. Just wanted to make sure.
So this relates to Oak Knoll Golf Course. Mm-hmm. So what permit do you have to get if you're booking a wedding at Oak Knoll?
You book a wedding at Oak Knoll Golf Course, and you work with a golf course manager. You don't have to book.
So it doesn't fall into this at all. So it doesn't even, the alcohol doesn't
There's
even fall into this?
It's a special wedding fee because they already serve alcohol at Oak Knoll Golf Course. That is something where that falls under their purview. So they're serving alcohol at the golf course. So they're in charge of that whole piece.
Okay. Then the other question I had was, in our last meeting, we discussed possibility at Oak Knoll, the vendor at Oak Knoll wanted to get a hard liquor license
mm-hmm.
at Oak Knoll.
Mm-hmm.
Would this ordinance preempt that from happening?
Mm-hmm. No. We don't have it. I don't think we're making a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
You just said alcohol.
Yeah. There's
the approval permit. Use possession,
but
they wouldn't have to get a.
But Oak Knoll is accepted in the ordinance.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
They've got an exception.
Yeah. Commissioner Mott.
So, if I can just really quickly talk about kind of what I see as far as if the commission wants to move forward with this, as far as what the timeline is, I don't think this, obviously, I'm not prepared to bring it back to the February meeting. I think I would be prepared to bring something back in March at our March meeting. But I think within that time frame, I'd also want to talk to the Ashland Police Department about, you know, some potential to add some criteria and clear standards on security with these events. I also, if we do bring this back to the commission, if I do bring this back to the commission in March, taking everything to council, it's going to require taking everything to council, it's also going to require taking all the fees, not only to the commission, but also to council for approval prior to being able to charge those fees to the special events groups. So there is a process here.
Yeah.
Which I, yeah.
Hey, so easy out.
Sorry, I think he was asking a question, right?
No, I just want to make a comment about something that I said. 501c, they can be, have nothing to do with city action, and none of their money goes to city action. But what I really want to say is, I just look at this as one more job. But my staff is telling me they're overworked, and it's going to just be one more thing, the burden on staff. And I just don't see that, it's not like this could be have any kind of significant money making for us. So I just wonder why we're doing it.
Because citizens ask us to.
Yeah.
When you ask,
like what we do every day. You know, somebody asks us to build a skills park or a low angle trailer, or, you know, a new something.
I think this would be a headache.
I think there is a benefit if somebody is doing an event in the park. And we have had people, we've had, you know, the commission, you know, some of the commissioners who've been on the commission for a long time. We have had groups that have come and asked for alcohol. And I think that when you look through, other agencies within the United States and within Oregon, you know, there is a process and a procedure for the allowance of alcohol in park areas. So I think it's something that if the commission wants to continue to pursue, I think we should pursue it. But do I necessarily think that this is all going to get pushed through before the festival in June? I don't know, because there is a lot to cover, and I want to make sure that we do. We want to make sure that we do it right. I think it's something that we should continue to consider, because I think it would be a benefit for some 501c3s and some events that are doing that in park areas.
Joel,
I appreciate hearing your perspective on that, because you're the people that do the work. Do you ever think about doing, I mean, they certainly served alcohol when they had bands at Oak Knoll,
mm-hmm.
At Rogue Music Festival, or whatever variation on that. Is that something that's been considered?
Absolutely. We've talked about it, but there isn't a process for that right now.
Right.
So,
right.
But It, the committee, the Ashland Memorial Music Festival committee, is would be very excited about being able to have some sort of that process available to them as well down the road. So
I think so.
It would be a benefit.
Julie, did you
have a comment? Well, one thing that, so if we liberalize the alcohol use rules for the park, it might not necessarily generate revenue for us, and it might be a benefit to the community perhaps at the moment, but I mean, it may be a test case for perhaps changing things again in the future in a way that is more where it does help support the, you know, the residence park. So I don't think it's, first of all, I think it's a reasonable thing to do for the 501c3 organizations because it's a benefit to them, and they are also our residents and our the people with support park. But I think it may be of some value to the APRC beyond that in the future, assuming that this goes well. The other thing I was going to ask you about is, do you want to have a year trial period like that, or written into this set of rules, or did you want to just leave that? Or?
I mean, I think we could, if this moves forward with the commission and the commission adopts these, you know, rules and regulations, we can say, we can ask to look ahead in a year. It could be added to the motion in a year, and we'll review it in a year to see where we're at.
Sure.
You know, can I, and just talking about the complexity of this and everything, and what Rachel's talking about is making sure that we take the time that we need to do this. I mean, I just mentioned that Oak Knoll is accepted, and then went back and looked at the proposed language, and we actually proposed that we cover the exception for Oak Knoll in the rules. And now I'm thinking we should actually just accept them from this and let them continue to do what they're doing. And so you know, there is a lot to think about this. So like C and D, we had proposed striking on the first page of the memo. I think we should probably consider bringing C and D back as part of the ordinance. Anyways, just an example.
As part of the
ordinance of the municipal code, just to get it out of the way, just say these ones are accepted and they're just going to continue to operate the way they are. Now, I guess the other option is to, at the top of the rules, say exactly what this says, that these two are accepted. These rules don't apply to them. These rules apply to those areas that Rachel mentioned, which are the Butler Banshill, da 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 da, those types of things. So.
So, I'm not really sure I'd be happy with it just dropping this, but I don't think that's where it's going. And if it isn't going that way, then I'd like what we do to be as strong and as useful as possible. Whether I'm on that, whichever side of the board I'm on. So, that being said, I did have a question, then I have a few comments. The question is, should this include APRC? The way I see this written currently, we couldn't sponsor our own event and have alcohol because it's limited to a 501c3, and we are not a 501c3. So it just, so anyway, that was a thought I had.
You could have it at the golf course.
Pardon me?
You could have it at the golf course.
You could have it at the golf course, sure.
I think it's a good addition, actually. It makes sense.
And then I think number two should just be eliminated. I don't see it has any value.
Number two is when they're not profit rules?
Of the rules, yeah. Non-profit events for the benefit.
Oh, yeah.
It's covered everywhere else. Mm-hmm. I just don't see it has any value.
Yeah.
Then number five. I'm not sure that's really quite, I don't think that's quite right, because the way this is written, you couldn't have hard cider, for example, wouldn't be allowed. And so I'm wondering, it depends on what the OLCC says, but maybe there's
there's
no, not over 18% or whatever that is.
There's certain terminology, I think, with that. Yeah, I'm looking at the places that have, like.
I just don't think it should just say it the way it says it, because I think there's a lot of lack of clarity. It doesn't cover everything.
Okay.
And if it used a percent, if that was applied to OLCC, that would be definitive. Oh, and then a couple of one more thing at least. I would like to see another, if this goes through, I'd like to see another stipulation, and that is to be a deposit. I think something like alcohol that has the potential with more trash, whatever, but I think a significant deposit should be charged. I don't mean $100, I mean $500 or $1,000, or something really significant. And it's a refundable deposit, but and it can be 100% refundable if everything's cleaned up and everything's fine afterwards. If stuff's broken, then we should have some deposits.
If they don't, if not allowed to bring that glass container, does that mean that they have to have all plastic disposable stuff?
Probably.
Cans.
Or cans.
Or beer. I'm sorry, you're right. Like a, or one of the beer comes in rather than a tin can, which is something that I cost online.
Is that consistent with our zero waste policy?
No. I mean, not my opinion.
I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, because a lot of
the... It'd be pretty dangerous though in the park to have.
Yeah.
I don't know what better alternative is, but...
But currently you can have a jar of juice.
Yeah, but you're talking about a big event, hundreds of people. Hundreds, potentially hundreds of glasses.
Well, and what? And when we do zero waste now, are there no glass plates or glass glasses?
But can't you use reusable plastic? I mean, when I go out, you know, for a picnic, I take a wine cup that is it's made for that purpose, but it's plastic. And they also make metal containers.
I was waiting for you to say, but not in Lithium Park, of course.
But of course not. That's not what you're
looking. I can look that
But what you could do, you could to address what you're talking about, is you could say no one-time use containers. Mm-hmm. You could say no glass, but no one-time use containers. And they got to figure it out. But those exist.
There's also share a plate. Maybe we could ask them if they...
Well, and I think the industry keeps coming up with things. I'm guessing there are some of the wineries that have, you know, something that is compostable or non-plastic, you know, paper. I mean, I don't know, but I'm guessing people are coming up with stuff.
Dixie cups. Classy Dixie cups.
Yeah.
I'll look into it.
Well, we're in the weeds.
So my suggestion, just looking at thinking about the workload for the next month, I'm thinking that I should work on this. I'm really trying. I want to meet with OLCC and talk with them a little bit more. I'm thinking that maybe I could bring this back in April. I don't think it's going to be ready in March to bring it back.
And I would just going along with that. Remember, we're trying to do a pool. And she's starting an RDAC.
We're implementing a software program.
Exactly. So.
I think that sounds like a reasonable timeline. If you move forward, I think we need to tell the Lions know that it's not happening this year.
I'll get a hold of Maggie.
Because it's a 60-day, that's the application, mm-hmm. 60 days before. This comes in April, it goes even if it's late April. Unlike the
council, can I just ask a question? Could we come up with some rules for Feast of Will? I think we'll learn a lot in that process.
Well, we have to do an ordinance amendment before we can Feast of Wills could ever do that.
Because it's illegal. It's illegal right now. Right. Okay,
I can get a hold of Maggie.
And let him know. I mean, it's better to do it right than
Just
a couple critical things that really need to be addressed, but time frame is probably not going to work for Feast of Will. So.
What I can do, and when I bring it back in April, is bring back some of these within the special event application, just kind of so we can like look at process and the guidelines and rules within the special event application, so you can see it all together.
That'd be great, and actually have it come back in that format.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah.
Okay, I agree.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, then we have IPM Exemption Boulevard information. Superintendent Oxendine.
Rachel actually handed this to me when I came in. It's the, it's just an article on Life Saves in the front of the Parks and Recreation magazine talking about how we're way ahead of the game with our IPM policy in comparison to most Parks and Recreation districts. But if anybody wants that, they can have it. So we recently had two of our employees who both work on boulevards go through traffic school. And they went through two different trainings. They went through a standard traffic school traffic safety program, and then they followed that up with a supervisor's training for traffic school. And they asked me what the difference in policy was between the north entryway, where we have an exemption from our IPM policy to spray glyphosate or herbicides in general on the north entryway because of a staff safety concern, with staff being in a median immediately adjacent to moving cars, and say the median in front of Southern Oregon University. So the exemption only is for the north entryway. And so I didn't really have an answer for them on that, so I started looking into it and trying to figure out, you know, what the difference there is. And the only thing I could come up with is that the speed limit is slightly lower as you get into town. It starts at 35 miles per hour and goes down to 25 miles per hour. And just thinking logically that we're not willing to have our employees get struck by a car, whatever speed it's traveling. So that didn't really, it didn't really sit well with me to, as an explanation for that. So I wanted to bring it to your attention, and I wanted to start that discussion and see what you all had to weigh in on that.
I have a question that predates my being on the council. Was they put in AstroTurf for some variation on that, on some of them closer to Omar's.
Just the one in front of Omar's.
Right. I thought that was viewed as successful. And I'm curious, has that been considered for others, for environmental purposes, for other reasons?
That project was funded in part by Julie Smitherman, water conservation specialist for the city of Ashland, as a test plot. And I think it got mixed reviews from the community. I don't know where it's at currently as far as whether people view it as a success or not. Those trees that are in that median still require the same amount of water they did before they put in the AstroTurf.
But you don't have to have people mowing right along.
We don't have to have people mowing right along the boulevard. It still does get weedy, and we have to chip it every year. And they recently put in Nandina to try and shade out some of that space so that it wouldn't get quite as weedy up along the trees. But even in the schemes of the AstroTurf itself, we have weeds sprouting up that we go through and hand pull.
Do you know when that was put in?
I don't.
It was probably 17.
No, it was
before that.
Which one are you talking about?
Right across from Omar's.
No, that was only just a few years ago. I was here for that.
Okay, then it must 16. Have been 5 years ago.
16. All right, 15.
15, okay.
All right.
So, because I was on the commission when we made that exemption for the north entrance, the reason we made that was because, number one, visibility of traffic. I realize that it may not be any safer than the University Boulevard section, but the fact was is cars are coming actually from a 45 mile an hour zone to turns to 35 about right there. The viaduct kind of cuts down on visibility, and You know, we were basically trying to limit where we used herbicides, but then realized that that was not a very safe area. You know, 25 miles an hour on the rest of Siskiyou Boulevard through town out to the university. Not everybody goes 25, but you know, there's quite a difference, I think, in vehicular speed between the two was the only reason we made that exception. Okay. Did you want to add?
Well, I'd like to say something on speed. It's speed limit isn't always the best indicator of what's actually going on, and 80%, the 80th percentile of, you know, how fast people are going, what the 80th percentile is usually a better indicator of safety. And I think that that's something that can potentially be an indicator of safety. And if we went with something like that, that might make a lot more sense. If there was a speed that, say, it's 35 miles an hour, well, there are plenty of 25 mile an hour streets where the 80th percentile is 35 miles an hour.
You know, and I'm not even speaking to that. I'm just trying to explain for your information exactly why we made that exception for that average. You know, we didn't analyze the traffic or anything. We just said, yeah, it sounds like a reasonable argument. It's probably less safe there than it is on the rest of the boulevard. And, you know, that's my recollection of why we did that.
I would add in as a person who lives at that end, and on that a lot, it also gets slowed down on a regular basis because of all the students crossing there, the high school crossing there. People are not, there are some, but there are people that race a lot of other places, and I don't see them on that one, just because there's constant traffic, cross traffic. So I think it is a safer, at least slower, and people are more aware when they're driving there. I know I am.
Julie?
Yeah. Is there, if you were to cover that strip in concrete, I assume that would be a lot more expensive than the maintenance costs for a year. But it would.
It's not ours anyways. We maintain it for the city, and they would have to. They'd have to want to do that. But so we've never explored that. But after Rick says something, I'd like to say something.
So it seems like it's always going to be a problem area. Either you spray the black estate or you have people staying there at risk of being hit by the traffic. And there's got to be some sort of financial way of figuring out which is the more practical thing to do. Not that there's a way of, you know, not that there's an easy way of covering the cost of somebody who actually got hit by a car. The safety is a different sort of issue. And I'm not crazy about covering everything with concrete, but it does seem like if people are really close to glyphosate, then the only practical alternative to that is either something like AstroTurf or covering with concrete. Or
not. I think that's kind of a wrong question, actually. The problem is, the reason it's weed there is because what's the main plant there? Roses? And some kind of grasses, and anyway, they're plants that you can predict before they were put in. You can predict they're going to produce a lot of weeds because they aren't covering the, they aren't making a solid coverage over the area. So I think what makes more sense is to put in a 2 to 4 foot tall evergreen, a pollinator like Archisaphilis, and then maybe you give an exemption for a couple of years for safety while those grow up. Once they cover up, there's really going to be hardly any maintenance and hardly any water needed. So it just seems like we're missing a potential win-win here.
Well, it's acknowledging it's the cities and not ours, right?
Yeah, we don't make the decision on what to plant there. We can make suggestions to the city on what to do there, but it's their deal. It's not a park.
Yeah, I understand, but in the big picture, that's the solution, and it's a low cost solution. But it's not the way things are done. But
I'm sorry, but they're not done in a logical way, in a way that saves money and creates a safer situation.
Well, the issue right now is that we have two employees who mow along that strip multiple times a week. They're out there on different strips multiple times a week. They're string trimming, or as I like to call it, weed eating, in the beds, which has caused some hazards for cars as well. Today we drove by, we were on our way somewhere with some staff members, and we drove by, and two of those people were right in front of the university on their hands and knees. And
In the shrub beds.
Well, actually, the head was close. One of their head was closer to the curb than it was the shrub bed. And I think that makes me a little uncomfortable, honestly.
But that's a good reason to get them out there totally. I mean, they still not go out there for glyphosate, or not go there to pull weeds, not do any of that. And so we're just perpetuating the problem, and while we're putting poison on there. So I just think we're not looking at the big picture here. Big picture, those are long plants. Those plants that are out there require maintenance, and they're going to require maintenance regardless. Whether truly it's less time to go spray than it is to pull it. Got it. But they still have to be out there. The solution is to put plants out there that don't require maintenance or have minimal maintenance.
And I don't disagree with anything that Rick is saying, but I also acknowledge that the other reason I wouldn't be as comfortable with bikes there is that's a high traffic pedestrian area. And stuff is blowing, people are walking through it. I think that I'd be concerned if my kid was going to school and walking through places like that. The chances of this.
And what I'm saying is that I would be willing to risk the glyphosate if we knew that it had the endpoint. But just to go and say, okay, this is just, we're giving up here and we're just going to do it, and this way it's all it can be, that sounds terrible. I just feel like we can do better than that.
I think that one of the reasons that the weed concentration is so high on the boulevards is because it's a heavily trafficked road, and weed seed is coming off of vehicles that are driving by. Every landscape truck that drives through Ashland that has all of their grass clippings and weeds in the back of their trailer is coming out into the boulevard medians. So they are our heaviest density of weeds per square foot is in the medians. And it's not just in the beds, it's also in the cracks that grow along the lines, right around the flagpoles, right around the light poles, right around the utility boxes. We can't mow close to those. There are plant-specific requirements out on the boulevard for height, so you can't have anything that gets over 36 inches. So they put in these shrub hedgerows so that they can continuously hedge prune these things down to keep them so that the sight lines from passing cars can see over the medians. The university uses glyphosate on all of its landscapes except for pollinator beds that are specifically sanctioned to not use it on. And the vehicular accidents are highest in that section in front of the university due to the sheer volume of people crossing the road. There's lots of rear-end vehicle collisions right there, and lots of pedestrians get in minor collisions there with cars. So I think that it's a solution to keeping our staff out of the medians as much as possible, and I'm not saying it's the best solution. I think that replanting the boulevard medians would be an excellent thing to do. Personally, I'd advocate for some street trees out there. But at this point, it is what it is. We're maintaining it for the city, and I can advocate to change the landscape. And Michael brought up a good point that I had forgotten to put in here, is that one of the other things that brought this up was we've had two rocks go through windows of passing cars this year from weed eater use on the boulevards, both in the section, just happens to be in the section that was by the university. They weed eat the section out of the north entryway too. So that it's just another thing that happens along the boulevards, and they'll continue to weed eat out there.
I think it's real appropriate for somebody I'm not sure who the best person is to talk to the city about. This is a lose-lose situation. You know, I mean, we're putting people at risk. We have issues of finances. We have. I don't get it why Parks and Rec is doing that, but I get why we do the schools. But a city gets to say, do this, and they don't deal with any of these complications and concerns. We're living with them, and I think they need to be aware. I don't think they're even aware this is a concern.
Well, they're paying us.
Well, no, I get that. I get that.
So it's
but you know, are we happy to be doing it? I don't get the sense that we are. And I my point is that we're having this discussion about city property, and city, as far as I know, maybe I'm wrong about this, city council has no idea that this is a significant issue, and I view it as a significant issue. As you say, people's heads are close to the. I see them go by, and I get concerned for them. But I also don't see, like you say, as the best solution. So I think they need to at least be aware of it, and maybe we can come up with something.
Is it possible to do like an experimental plot, like half of, or ask the city if we can plant it with evergreen shrubs in one area? I mean, it would be relatively simple to trim the tops off to keep them at 3.5 feet potentially.
Or plant emerald green connecting, and that's how the plot grows.
Sure, or so
we don't have to maintain it.
But maybe we could do a test plot to see how much it reduced the maintenance and leave the rest of it as what it is at the moment and spray life as it on for the time being.
I'll just say one of the things I'd like to know first is what that cost to put in, and you know whether the city's going to reimburse us for that. I mean, if we do a small patch, I mean, I guess we could do that, but we have a lot of other priorities too, so we'll have to look at that.
I'm a little bit glad to say I thought I was on a commission when that North thing happened, but what I recall is that it wasn't just, it was pre-emergent was what was being applied out there. Was I incorrect?
I don't know anything about pre-emergent. I didn't see that in the policy at all.
No, it didn't say pre-emergent. It just said that you could spray out there. But I thought when the talk was there was going to be, that was the point, to put pre-emergent. Is that not happening out there?
No.
You're just glad to see.
Well, currently we're not doing any of that.
Well,
besides mediating it.
Well, I think we should look at.
No. I'm talking about North Main.
Yeah.
I think we should look at what the actual exemption is, because I don't believe it says pre-emergent.
No, it does. All it says is that the herbicides are allowed.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that at the time, I thought pre-emergent was the approach that was being used. So, and I'm just asking if that is what's being used out on North Main or not.
No. And that's not what I would suggest either.
So I have a question. So use of glyphosate, if you could use it all on all the boulevard medians, you would probably still have to do some trim work, wouldn't you? And you'd still have to mow.
Sure.
So the employees are still going to be on the median.
Yep.
And rocks potentially still fly. Yep. Right. So I just wonder if that's the solution. Is spray is just the solution, or if it just, I don't know, it just doesn't.
It's about mitigating risk by reducing the potential for risk to an acceptable level. And if you can reduce the time that they spend in the hazardous area, then you've reduced their risk significantly.
Yeah.
And they spend the majority of their time outside of the summer months weeding the boulevard medians as opposed to mowing them when the grass isn't growing. So. And that'll free them up potentially to do more work for us.
What if we just told the city we didn't want to do the boulevards?
Well, they'd. Yeah, we would lose the revenue from that.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm just saying.
Which could potentially relate to the positions that we have.
Right.
Yeah, okay, it's not just the boulevards that the city pays us to do. It's the airport, and it's all of the parking areas in town, and some street trees, and Briscoe, and the library, and...
Right, but you basically trade one risk for another risk. That's what, that's the problem I'm having, kind of with the discussion, is,
yeah.
You know, you have physical risk of vehicular accidents, and you have the risk of spraying chemicals.
So, it is an option to say that. I think probably where we need to go with this is to start looking, because we're not getting the reception that would lead me to believe that we're going to be able to use glyphosate out there. So as a mitigating factor for safety. So I think we need to look at other options, which would potentially start with maybe different kind of plantings, things like that. See if that's feasible, and if it gets to a point where our staff really thinks that they're not safe, we feel like they're not safe, then we don't do it. So
another option is to obviously do this not at rush hour, but to reduce the traffic to one lane, you know, and cone it and sign it, and so that you have a full lane of safety between where the cars are. And that being said, I'm willing to go with herbicides as a transition, but just to make it, this is what we're doing. The other thing about the lawn part, using herbicides on them, which I don't know if that's exactly what you're talking about, but that is part of the medium, is that is, you know, 4th of July, that is a spot where it's people are all over that. But anyway, I'd like to see us do something a little more imaginative than just say the only solution for safety. I want staff to be safe, but I think there are some other solutions, short term and long term.
Can I point out a social norm that occurred to me while I was sitting here listening to the alcohol argument for alcohol in the parks, is that alcohol is a well-known poison that people willingly ingest, and it causes far more deaths than glyphosate ever will. And I find it ironic that there's so much social pressure to affect change when it comes to certain items, but not others. And I just wanted to put that out there. The way I see it in my mind is quite interesting.
One distinction I make is the willingly part.
Yeah.
People could choose to spray glyphosate on their own garden, they do.
Yeah. And I appreciate that.
No, but you're absolutely right.
I just think about that.
We are crazy.
It's just
it's our crazy.
Yeah. It's whatever is socially acceptable. And right now, the use of herbicides is not socially acceptable, and I totally understand it.
But I still would, and I guess I just want to ask a question. If we do want the city to become aware of it and to give some thought to it, is it best for Mike to do it, for you to do it, for me as a concerned citizen and commissioner to say, can we do something about this and have them look into it at least?
So I don't want to take this farther than we need to take it, or make it a bigger issue than we need to take it. So I think this is an issue that Mike can discuss with the superintendent of public works.
Sure.
And they can talk about the different options that there are and what kind of safety issues. And one of the questions that I would have for the public works superintendent is, what would you do if it was your crew out here? Would you cone a lane off? Would you, what would you do? Understanding that glyphosate wasn't an option. So.
Do we have a superintendent of public works?
Yes. Yeah, we do.
That's a great point.
Superintendent.
Mike Morrison.
Mike Morrison.
Yeah.
What's Scott Flurry?
He's a deputy director.
Okay.
We have a new position out of the world.
Well, Scott's a PE now, too.
Mike Morris on city council.
Morris was on. Morrison is the. So that's where we'll go.
I would really hate for it to get back to the employees of APRC that we don't care about their safety, because I don't think that's the point of this. I think what's been expressed by a couple commissioners is that there's probably more than a single solution, and this one doesn't look that good to us right now. But you know, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it is the right solution. I don't know.
Well, and I would also say that this is there's more than one safety issues being talked about here. And we have the immediate safety of the people on the ground. We have the long-term safety of the people walking in the area, you know, and whatever's coming from glyphosate. So it's not the flowers are more important or the shrubs are more important. There are two safety issues here that the commissioners are weighing. If I'm saying something wrong, let me know. But that you're saying right now the glyphosate is still a bigger issue.
And I don't know that I'm saying that. I think they're both important issues, and I think that I just don't think they're mutually it's mutually exclusive. I think we can create safety for our staff, which is for me a real priority. I think we can do that without resorting to herbicides, and so that's really. But if you were to come back to me and say, for this and this and this and this reason, this is the only option, well, I'm going to think differently of it. But at this point, I have mentioned at least two options, and I'm sure there's more, and I think we need to explore that. But what we need to do is, in short order, increase the safety of people out there. I'm fully supportive of that.
I agree. I think you have good suggestions, and I feel like I have good direction as far as I will talk to Public Works and see what they're willing to pay for and what they're willing to do to change the current planting design of the boulevards and what a feasible timeline for that is. Right now, we've got a lot going on.
I think there's another section to that. I mean, I don't know that Public Works is going to jump to funding a replacement of a bunch of material. The other safety options are coning and signing and things like that. I mean, if we worked for the federal government, we'd probably close down the whole road while we were doing this, you know. So that's why I think the question that one of the questions that needs to be asked is, if this was your staff, how would you approach it? What do they do when they have to paint curbs? What do they do, you know? I mean, they don't do the exact same thing that we do, but if they did, what would be their
protocol? I mean, that's a good analogy. I mean, it happens less frequently, but that's exactly what they would do.
And there's a good point that it happens less frequently. We're out there constantly. And I do think a little signage, you know, people at work, isn't a bad, you know, interim thing to make people more aware. Because you're driving there, you're not expecting to see somebody right on the edge of the curb there.
They do currently put up signs on either side of the boulevard section that they're working in. They just use the big construction work ahead signs.
But it doesn't restrict any access to any of the lanes.
No.
You could kill a city employee, $15,000 fine, and 7 years in jail. That would...
Yeah. That's it.
I think reducing to one lane is a reasonable safety measure.
How often would that happen?
Every day. Well, pretty much every day at some point in the boulevard.
A different section
of the boulevard.
Yeah, I think that
maybe some traffic calming.
Well, you might make an argument for
traffic calming
for a road diet, be like, hey, look, it works just fine when we do it every single day. You can just
might put some pressure on to put some plants in it, it didn't require so much maintenance.
That's probably more likely what the situation would be. If people are complaining that it's hard to get through town because of our maintenance,
we have a solution.
Yes, we do. So
There's also a bike lane on either side of it, right? On the outside of it. They could put the bike lane on the inside of it next to the median strip, and that would save a lot of, that would give you a buffer zone that was up there all the time.
Yeah, I don't think I'd buy this too much.
Well, see, I think that's the dilemma. I don't think bikers would, and I don't think drivers would like to, that's a very busy median, and to have it down to one lane constantly.
I think there's a way that it would work, but you'd have to take it down to one lane.
Well, you still have to have you have two lanes and a bike lane. You can just put the bike lane on the other side. But, you know, it would take a bit more than just putting it.
Yeah, there's a lot of engineering and striping that would have to happen, because you'd have to.
But there's also, what I would be most concerned about as a bicyclist is
you can't get off.
People can't get off, but that's one thing. But I'd be more concerned about the fact people expect me to be riding to the right. If all of a sudden I'm over here, people aren't expecting there, and nowhere else in the world is bike lanes.
That's not true.
Very few places in Oregon are going to find.
Yeah, it would be a new concept, but I guarantee. There's a way that it would work.
And then actually, that's really, in a way, what you're saying is you've now cut down the speed and the size of the mass coming at them. So clearly that would be safe.
You know, that's a better idea, is actually taking out the medians and just making it a two-way bike lane right through the center of town. I mean, that's what they are doing in D.C. and New York and bigger places like that. They have major bike facilities right in the middle of four lane roads, and it's working out.
Yeah, concrete.
Do they put trees in there too, or is it just?
No, there's barriers on either side. There might be planters or jersey barriers or something like that, but yeah, it is an acceptable practice with the right engineering. So
interesting.
So I think the bottom line is we need some more information from you, maybe some more exploration with the city, and get some feedback.
Deal. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you. Items from commissioner staff that we already haven't hashed over tonight.
I'll be out of town next 2 days. I'll be in Astoria. It's our yearly thing, but it is Salem work, but it's in Astoria, so it just makes it harder to get to. So.
And I'll be returning middle of March.
And we're starting in March. We're beginning our new regime.
Right. Meeting. And I'm going to miss the first meeting also.
Mm-hmm. Of March.
The study session, which is first Wednesday in March.
And by the way, is our the city newsletter, is it coming out correctly?
What?
Huh? Yes. Sorry. With our meeting dates and times?
Yeah.
It is.
Perfect.
Yes. Did we make any headway with Tina?
On what?
On she was in charge of.
Didn't we announce that?
Yeah.
What, with the courts?
Yeah, I thought we announced that.
You told me, but maybe it wasn't in the meeting.
I don't know what we're talking about, but that may be my memory.
Okay, so Sean was working really hard trying to get the courts to agree to shorten their jury day to allow us to enter into the chambers at 6 p.m. as opposed to 6:30, or start a meeting at 6 as opposed to 6:30. It got escalated up to the boss of the courts, which is Tina Gray. I had a discussion with her, and then they had more discussions on their end, and then we got an email back and said wish we could, but sorry, can't do it. So 6:30, they don't want to change their trial date time. I think they're worried that they would have to come to us once in a while and ask for us to change our time,
and that's not good.
No, that's not good. So I say we tried. Didn't we try?
We did try.
We tried. Sean tried really hard. I jumped in at the last minute.
I mean, it sounds like it was a no-brainer.
Well,
who are you calling a no-brainer?
No, I'm just saying, though, I saw her and she goes, yeah, we can probably work that out.
I think there was a point where it was like, this makes a lot of sense. And then
it all fell apart.
It kind of swung the other direction.
we were expecting an email saying, yeah, we can do that for you. But they must have come up with a, I think it was them thinking, well, you know, it'd be easier for them to start at 6:30 all the time than us asking them once in a while to change their time from 6. It's reasonable. It's speculation.
So is that just regarding the study session?
No. Both meetings. Both. It's, is it just, was it, was the...
It's every Wednesday. That
it's every Wednesday.
Yeah.
Okay. It, well, yeah, I won't go into details. So
the only other thing I would add is, so I've been going to the, I went to the last city council meeting that put the discussion regarding this possibility of a city bond for general obligation bond for City Hall and other facilities. I would just say there's probably a good chance that the Butler Proxy Fund will fall off of that list of items to be included on a potential general obligation bond.
Are they trying to cut it back in several ways?
Not in several ways, but I just don't see that getting any traction. You know, they're still hung up on City Hall, let alone the other facilities. So it'd probably be a benefit if Pioneer Hall and the community center got it left on.
Yeah.
But I don't see the fountain being left on it.
Which we've been advocating for through our channels.
The Pioneer Community Center.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I agree with you. I think probably will. And they do have to make a decision next week. So next Tuesday, they have to make a decision. Oh, well, that reminds me. Our offices are closed on Monday. That's actually why we're having this meeting today. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we have upcoming meeting on February 24th, regular business meeting. We have senior advisory committee on March 9th, Recreation Division Advisory Committee on March 12th, and B-City USA on March 18th. Beyond that, meeting adjourned.
Okay.
Is there a discussion of Bear Creek Greenway extension or something like that. The thing that I talked about. The Mace property. I think I'm going to maybe put it on February. Well, March. We're in February. I can't believe we're at March. But March or April. So.
Okay.
Let's put it on the March.
The biggest thing is to make the park easier. And, you know, it's like the goal is to save as many trees as possible.